Aloha, and welcome to another candid conversation. You might have noticed the grin on my face because I've got two guys online with me that are going to cause a lot of trouble to you folks now and in the future. One gentleman's name is Metz Kramer, who has coined the term digital dealership. We were just talking about him getting a trademark, in which case we'll change the subject to matter as to what we talk about. And the other is Alex Kraft, who transitioned, both of them actually, have transitioned from equipment dealerships into separate businesses. And Alex is focused on enhancing, improving the customer relationship, the customer experience with salesmen. So that's about as far as I want to go in introducing this. I want to let the guys maybe make a short comment at the beginning, and then let's just have a conversation. Metz, do you want to start, seeing as how you look like you're the oldest?
Ouch. That you included?
No. Don't start.
I think the one thing I learned over the last month is that one, although I do think I should trademark the digital dealership, it's definitely confusing. And I think, you know, in our little preamble and laughs leading up to this, one thing that's become really clear is that while we kind of want to approach this from the angle of what dealers should be doing, like how dealers should be modern, what's driving it is the change on the customer side. And why we do this and why we get all riled up is because, you know, we're seeing what's changing on the customer's expectations and in the different generation doing the buying. And forcing or trying to force this change in our industry. And that's what I think we need to come to grips with and get people to understand.
Alex?
Yeah, I think it's very well said. I mean, there's a lot of different places to go. I don't think we're forcing anything, number one. I do look forward to talking more about this industry is not any different than any other industry. And I'm sure we'll talk about it with depth, is that dealers aren't, it's completely natural to have hesitation, to not want things to change. And that's why I come back to it's not any different than any other industry. There is a great opportunity for some to embrace it faster or with more seriousness than others. And that's, you know, that's what I want to focus, you know, really the discussion more around, is for those that want to think more strategically, there's a great opportunity to do X, Y, and Z that can maybe take a little bite out of those that, you know, naturally want everything to remain the same. And, because it is, like Matt said, it's driven by the customer. It's not driven by me. It's not driven by Matt. It's not driven by you, Ron. It's not driven by, because customers are the one who have the power. And it's really not talked about as much. Working for a dealer, you realized it because your first lever when you knew that the deal was really, really competitive was to drop the price, because that signals that the customer has the power. And so, ironically, all of these things that we talk about actually help not always having to reduce the price. Like, for example, if you can make things a lot easier for the customer, you don't have to drop the price, you know? Yep. And so that's the irony in all of this, is that I think a lot of deal or businesses think technology, a lot more information to the customer means, oh, automatically I have to adjust my price. It's not that way.
It's kind of what we saw in automotive, right? When the web started printing all of the factory pricing on the web, that information brought everyone to a point where they went into the dealers with the factory pricing and said, this is what I'll pay. But I don't think that you're right. It's not the equivalent here. And it's not right. What it has to come down to.
Well, and also, like, think about the customer, right? What did customers absolutely despise with cars? Oh, going there and then knowing the dance that you were going to have to do, right? Well, let me see your manager. Oh, let me come back. you know? And so the publisher of the pricing was actually better for both sides, right? The dealer, like I said, if you're a dealer salesman, do you really want to have to, let me bring my manager over here and then it takes, you know, 8 hours to close one deal? Or would you rather the transparency? And now I actually can maybe make some more money and sell more cars. It's no different.
Let me just make a comment in the middle of this. The automotive industry was very clever when they published the prices, because they controlled the margins that the dealers made. Mm-hmm. The way that the dealer made his money was the amount of rebates they got or discounts they got at the end of periods. And the customer didn't know that. Mm-hmm. In the old days, before they published prices, we were always dancing around trying to find out their cost and their list and how much we were prepared to give them. Well, all of that went away.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see some of that. John Deere has more than one price for the same model machine. Caterpillar now has two prices for the same model machine. These things are getting, I think people are so gun shy. What's your price? Can't you do better than that? Mm-hmm. It's about the values, folks, that we provide. And that's what you guys are focused on.
Absolutely. There's got to be something other than price.
Yeah.
And that can be achieved through what I'm sure we'll talk about.
You know, Metzer, Alex, one of you said that, you know, the customers don't want to see the salesman anymore. It's kind of, you know, don't call me. I'll call you when I have something that I need.
Yeah, that's the I actually just talked to the two guys that did the podcast at AED, and they were a customer dealer rep relationship that are now doing podcasts together. And they live that paradigm. You know, one guy being told he had to go visit customers, and he knew that his customers didn't want to see him. And that, and there was a younger customer, and he just made it really clear. Like, I know what I want. I'm researching it at night on my sofa. Mm-hmm. And I'll text you when I need to do something. You don't need to show up.
Right. Or, I mean, really what they're saying is there's no need for you to come here if you don't have anything. If there's nothing, like if you're not bringing, like, I mean, I read your article, Metz, and it's excellent. You talk about, hey, if you're going to go stop by in person, bring value for there to be a reason. And, you know, it's been this way for a long time, right? You talked about how, well, you pretended to have value by bringing a brochure. That's just like camouflage for, I don't really have any value, but here's like a piece of paper. And that's really what it is. People are too busy, and the customers know about the machines, you know, but if you're going to come, bring value. If not, then, you know, let me control the interaction. Let me text you or call you when I need something.
Yeah. I think you're the example of that by putting that, let me control the transaction approach into your platform. Mm-hmm. and getting customers to recognize that the old way of having your rep at your dealer show up on a regular enough basis that you're getting what you need from them isn't working. So mm-hmm. you find those customers that want to change the paradigm and just be like, this is what I want. Like, who's going to come to the table and give me a price and tell me when they can deliver what I want? No, I don't think anywhere in your platform does it say, can you send me a brochure?
we did build in like digital brochures that you can download, but, but you know, it's funny because it's not just customers. It also helps the salespeople. It's not worth the salesperson's time, a really good one, to just go show up for 2 minutes and then drive another 40 minutes to go show up. And so like the technology can work for both, right? It helps salespeople better prioritize because, you know, their time is valuable too.
So what is it about, like, you've been in the role, Alex, what is it about the comfort that some management people get from knowing that they've invested $60,000 in a truck and whatever, 100 grand in the person, and that if that person is driving around in his truck, then and talking to some people, that's good. Like, where does that come from, and why is that something that we're holding on to?
You know, I'm reading this book right now, written by a former MIT professor in the 60s. It's called Men, Machines, and Modern Times. And he writes about technology in 1960. And one of the things that he talks about, he lays out like different periods in history as examples of like why people push back on technological advances, is that one of the reasons is, well, because this is just the way we've always done it. And I think that is part of what the answer to your question is, well, because who typically leads the dealership and sales organization? It's typically the longest tenured salesman.
Yeah.
You know, that person, you know, is now promoted, their VP of sales or whatever. And well, how did that person come up? He was a young salesman. He was taught to go call on customers. He was taught to just show up, you know, everybody know, you know, the same like stereotype. And so I think there's that is at play with a lot of it, is that, well, that's just the way everyone's always done it. It's worked, right? Because I had years where I sold 20 million of equipment and whatnot. And so there's no reason to do anything different. I think that's a big part of it.
You know, in the old days, it used to be that the market leaders didn't want to change anything. They had everything under control.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the people who were trying to challenge the market leader that, you know, they used all kinds of different slogans. So we had Coke is the real thing, and it's the Pepsi challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's Kleenex, that's a generic term for a brand. It's Kodak, that was a generic term for a brand. Caterpillar has become a generic code. And I guess the best one today in our world is probably Bobcat.
Exactly.
You know, everybody calls that skid steer a Bobcat.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that was interesting about it to me is, you know, Caterpillar and many others started doing loader backhoes and went after Case. And Case wasn't particularly adept or quick at it. And then they turned around and went after Melrose, Bobcat. But what happened was the Bobcat skid steer marketplace is more automotive than construction equipment. So it's more a first-time buyer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's name recognition. Then we have this generational thing between boomers like me and you know, the greatest generation that are older than me and the silent generation is the ones that they were in First World War. And you guys, the millennials, the Zs, and the Xs, is we're comfortable with how mm-hmm. things are. You guys aren't. And I wasn't either at your age. You know, I was always asking why you do it that way, you know, and you know, when people ask me why, I always say, why not? Trying to provoke a little bit of a discussion. And I think the answers you guys got was, well, it's because it's always been done that way here.
Yeah.
Whenever you hear it's always done that way, boy, oh boy, is that ever a signal something needs to change?
Yes.
So how do we, you know, and both of you have made the comment that most of the purchasing that's done in this country, in this industry anymore, is people under the age of 40.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They got a different view on things. And you guys are just responding to it. Change is a blessing. You know, mm-hmm. we confront change our whole life. It starts with birth, for goodness sake.
And the it's last an opportunity.
Is death, you know. I mean, and there's many in between. It's really challenging. I'm calling it business intelligence because I don't want Metz to be able to trademark the digital dealership. but it really is digital intelligence, isn't it?
I think overall it's strategy. And then like underneath strategy are different pieces. And I think intelligence is one, you know, data. How do you use data? Because I'm sure we could say with confidence that most dealerships and it's companies in other industries, they have all this data and they just don't really use it. Like they don't compile it in a certain way. You know, when I was at the former dealership, like everything was we had to like download it into Excel and then manually play around with it for 5 hours to then get it to where I could spend 30 minutes actually analyzing it. It's insane.
Yeah.
But I think it's just overall what we're talking about is strategy. And you know, that's I love that part, right? And I think too, what shapes you is that I was not at a cat dealer. So, you know, we had to constantly talk about strategic decisions on who to pursue customer wise, how do we increase business in a certain market? Cause we weren't number one. And so that was very valuable experience for me personally.
Did you then, like when you develop strategy, if we were, the three of us were to get together on Saturday and I buy a bunch of pizzas for my digital dealership trademark money, and we start a new dealership, we would base it on like what we know. We would base it on like a marketing plan, right? And this is what I think is fascinating about a lot of dealers is they have marketing departments and like strategy comes out of marketing. And you have sales strategy, but like sales strategy is also a large part of like developing sales tactics, right? Mm-hmm. Strategic planning is really tactics planning. And yet, so we have these marketing departments. These marketing departments spend their time doing, you know, a subset of marketing, and our strategic development of our dealership. If the three of us start one on Saturday, that's where we start, right? We start by looking at the market, like you've done with Heave. And if we did it for a dealership, we'd look at like, what does the market look like now? Mm-hmm. What does the customer look like now? Mm-hmm. You know, we know the product because we're a dealership. We're not defining the product to a large degree. And that's where we start from. And yet that piece of it is the thing that seems to be missing at a lot of dealers. You know, the marketing department is small and it's mostly advertising people, and they do some like parts and service promo things, and they run a campaign on backhoes. That's not specifically marketing, right? Mm-hmm. It's not rethinking what is our approach to the market. Mm-hmm. And if we know what the market is like, and that they're reading everything, they're learning everything, they've got, you know, all the hard product videos that we used to produce or the manufacturers produce and make available through us to show to the customer, that's all online. It's all on YouTube. You know, I can find 27 contractors that'll evaluate the next 938 and decide and tell me if it's good or bad. So all of that is there. If we look at that piece of it and say that is no longer our realm, then how do we build a new strategy? How do we add value to the sales process, to the, you know, how do we develop a sales strategy that recognizes that our customer has fundamentally changed from what they were?
How do you establish? So let's do that company. We're going to get together. We're going to have a bunch of Coca-Cola. We're going to, you know, be very generous to thank Metz a lot for the copyright information that he's got and trademark information to pay for this lunch. But, you know, what I would probably do first is I'd probably get the Randall Publishing, the old EDA, Equipment Data Associates, and find out what machines are in this country or whatever geography we want to play with are the most popular. And then I'd probably list off every customer who financed a machine, one of those machines, over the last 12 to 24 months. And I'd received this file. And it might be in Excel that we have to mess with. It might be comma separated, CSV files, whatever. Mm-hmm. We've got formatting dilemmas because it doesn't all comply and people put it in different ways. So there's a mess in the data. But I get the data and then, okay, I'd say, guys, okay, call some of these people. Let's have a short survey. Do you want to see a salesman? What's important in the sales transaction? Are specs important? Is price comparison important? What is it? And from that, I'd create an equipment fax, just like Carfax. Spec out your machine online. We'll make available all of these different machines. Everybody who has an inventory machine, from Alex's perspective, we'll get them to load it up such that anybody who's looking for a machine can see. They can see the specs, they can see the hours, they can see the inspections, they can place an order. We can value their trades, we can deliver the machine, and we'll give them 30 days to keep it or get rid of it. If somebody dropped that in on a machine that's $100,000, that's okay, that's easy. For $1 million? Holy mackerel, baby. I think that's part of our dilemma, isn't it? The cost of capital and the size of the transaction gets in the way a bit.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I think, too, what you have to define in the beginning is who are we competing against? And who are the customers that we want to go get? And that's because I'm assuming for the purpose of this exercise, we're not a cat dealer, right?
Well, you know, the situation here is, I think in the discussion, we should be thinking in terms of brand independence. Mm-hmm. We represent no brand. We're a conduit for buyers to buy from sellers. We're trying to make the transactions easy. Now, the customers are going to love this. The dealers won't.
Well, someone's going
to. That's a powerful statement. That's a, because that statement is contradictory, right?
Of course.
And that's what I love to discuss, is that successful businesses want it to be. I read a really interesting article yesterday on like Harvard Business Review, and it talked about customers don't necessarily want a business to exceed expectations. They want it just to be easy. Because yep. There's such a small percentage of times where like a company exceeds expectations. And you hear that term sometimes. Hey, we're going to exceed expectations. And then it creates kind of confusion within that company. Oh my God. And pressure, right? When most customers just want you to just deliver what you say. Like, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to provide this level of service and just hit that. But what drives most, and this speaks to the societal shift that Metz has recognized and that I see, is that, you know, customers want a simple solution. They don't want to have to babysit certain things. Like, and Ron, we talked about this last time that we discussed. It's such a valuable exercise to understand what is the job we're performing for the customer? You know, what is the role that we provide? And that's where, you know, we could start with our dealership, is that, okay, you know, who are our target customers? Like, what is our niche? And then what is the job that they're basically hiring us for that we are going to do better than everyone else? And then just and deliver on that job. And then, of course, who are we competing with? You know, you started by, and it's the right thing to do, surveying the market, you're finding out what's important to customers, and then finding out where the gaps are with the competition that we have, you know, and then making sure that we deliver. You know, that's the fun part of strategy.
Interesting thing, if you take what you're going at, we want to exceed expectations. As a guy who's been in the consulting world for more than 40 years, there's been so many different devices used to repackage the same darn thing. Mm-hmm. The getting to simplicity finally gets us to the right place. I want to exceed expectations. Terrific. How do you know that? How do you know if you have it? Well, you got to know what the expectation is. Well, do you ask? No, I haven't asked. And then, right. You know, how do you measure customer satisfaction? It's the gap between expectations and realization, the perception of the service. How do you find that? You got to ask. Nobody asks. Mm-hmm. To Metz's term, marketing at a dealership, In most dealerships, and this is not a happy comment, is brochures and trade shows.
Yep, 100%.
That's not what marketing is, darn it.
No. It's
never been.
It's I don't think it's unique, like Alex said. It's not unique to our industry.
No.
Oh, no.
We certainly, like any established business, forgets the importance of their marketing. And I like that when we started our exercise, that the first thing Ron did was go get a bunch of data to understand customers and what's in the market, the equipment data that's in the market, what people have bought, so that we know who to target. I mean, that's step one. He didn't say, like, we buy 3 pickup trucks and we all drive around and try and find out, you know.
Who's we hand out hats and T-shirts.
Right. And I got to, you know, $1,000 gift card from Starbucks that I can spend and hand out. You know, we didn't start there, like, because we recognized that, one, we wanted to understand the customer's expectations, and I think, you know, the thing we've all come to realize is that expectations have changed. But two, we wanted to apply the information that was available to meeting those expectations and how we want to run the business. Mm-hmm. And we come right back to what we all recognize is, like, how do we get people to understand that, one, expectations are changing, and how to use the information that's telling them that expectations are changing in their business to meet those customer and not exceed the customer expectation.
Let me stick another little point in the middle to provoke something. It's not that long ago that we used to hire somebody. We'd introduce them around. We'd take them around. We'd give them the keys to their vehicle, take them to their vehicle, show it to them, give them a list of customers and say, there's the door, see ya.
It still happens today.
No, but isn't that amazing?
I find it amazing, yes.
The other piece of the puzzle that I find even more amazing is I'm going to give you a specific geography. And in that geography, as the dealer employer, I don't know what you're saying to anybody. You're defining my brand. You're defining who I am. And I haven't got a clue what it is you're saying.
That's right.
That doesn't make me comfortable either.
Yeah.
No.
You know, with texts, with emails, I've got a track that I can go back to. You know, there's a software package out there now that'll take meetings like this and it'll transcribe our talking into a Word document, just like a Dragon or a ViaVoice or one of these things. We're all looking for simplicity, as Alex said. Mm-hmm. Make it easy. And we had this wonderful expression decades ago, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. It was almost a mystical desire. Today, it's not mystical. People want it simple because it's a complex world out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's not just complex. It's that I honestly think people are doing more than they ever did, right? Like, we're more productive than we used mm-hmm. to be. It used to be okay to spend 3 days buying a machine, you know, in total. But now you'd be hard pressed to find 3 days in your next month's schedule to spend on a purchase mm-hmm. when there aren't that many details to sort out. So, like, we want to keep it simple, but we also need to meet, like, what time we have to allocate to various things. And I think sometimes we think, you know, I learned this lesson when I was in the material handler business. We thought we were selling, like, the Mac Daddy machine to the customer. We thought, like, the machines we were selling were the big thing that they bought, you know, near $1 million material handler. And only to learn that they didn't care. Like, they would buy them like cookies, because what they were really excited about and spending all their money on was a shredder. And that thing was like 6 to 10 million. Right. And that's where they spent their time. That's where they were interested. And the material handler was like, well, we need three. Just drop them off. Mm-hmm. You know, and yet our approach to it was like we were selling them shredders. We thought we were the shredder salesman. You know, and I think that's the more we learn to understand what our customer really, what's valuable to them, and then meet that expectation. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's where our next conversation for, you know, our new dealership is, we don't put guys in trucks with Starbucks cards. Mm-hmm. You know, we do training on trying to understand your customer, understanding their expectations, and then training them to bring value when they show up. So what are those value? What are those things that in today's world add value?
Right. And I think it's a really good breakout is that I believe the salesperson going forward has to be like a hybrid of sales and service. Like, I don't think that value can be any more of price, you know, like taking people to lunch, taking people to dinner, buying beers, and then here's your price. I think the salesperson has to be a hybrid of someone who can help either make sure, I'm not saying fix the actual machine, but like be a liaison, like a dependable liaison between, you know, between your service department and the customer. Because I've also seen it too, where You know, some customers didn't like calling the service department because they felt like, hey, you're the one who got the commission when I signed the $1 million order. And so, you know what? You make sure you help solve my problem. Don't, you know, if I call you and say, and you ask me, hey, did you call my service department? Wrong answer, right? Like, you're the face of the company. Like Rob was saying, hey, we put these guys out. Like, hey, this is the face of the company. Yeah. So I think that is part of the value going forward. And I've had customers tell me previously, like, hey, we don't want a salesman. And they're not, because in the full background is that they were a national account customer. So the pricing was agreed upon between the manufacturer and the customer. So literally, why would you have a salesman come out here? Just give us a PSSR and give us support resources. And so I think that is the template going forward, is that you have to have people who are more knowledgeable about the operation of the equipment and how to troubleshoot and help get problems serviced.
I totally agree. I think those are the people that customers value, you know, because they can help solve problems. Mm-hmm. I would add to that the capital understanding. I know a lot of customers, you know, see value. And I work with some dealers who really understand the finance space, the capital, you know, the capital expense of equipment, the market values, you know, and there's significant money left on the table if it's not done well. You know, mm-hmm. you could work a project to the bone, you know, and walk away with $100,000, or you could manage the fleet better through the project and pick up $100,000, you know, and I think bringing those two pieces, especially with the complexity of equipment nowadays, bringing those two pieces together as a sales rep / fleet manager brings a lot of value. Like our biggest customers at CAT, we had dedicated fleet manager / account reps, and they tracked every machine and utilization and, you know, repair problems and rebuild times, and because that brought a lot of value, and they were always welcome in the door.
Right. Yeah, I think the salesperson who's like, hey, let's go hire just the most outgoing personality because he's not afraid to talk to people. He doesn't know a damn thing about the product, but people like him. I think that profile will be extinct.
Yeah, I saw some article about that. I only got the headline of it and the punchline, which was like, introverts make better salespeople or something.
I just edited a piece from a client in Europe who's starting a blog with us. She is in Belarus and works at the university, and she's with a Dutch company from the Netherlands. It's kind of a weird combination. And she's talking about loyalty relative to employees. So the question I'd like to put out to you, I think I've heard over the last 10 years, go back 5 years, it seems that each 5-year increment, the attention to loyalty has dissipated to the point that today everybody who's selling something will say, oh, a customer has no loyalty anymore. If that is not a reflection of the fact that we haven't looked after our customers, I don't know what is.
Yeah, it's their fault.
Yeah.
That's it.
I've done all I can.
Damn guys are not loyal anymore, you know?
I love this topic, and this is why probably I won't be invited to talk at many places, but to me, the coded language of, hey, it's a relationship business, relationship, is people are trying to say, hey, well, that customer bought because they like me. And yes, I mean, people typically aren't going to spend $500,000 or whatever it is with somebody they dislike, mm-hmm. but you know, once it comes back to value, right? Like you have to deliver beyond the price in order to continue to earn the customer's business. And if you're losing X amount of business, it's because the customer's telling you with their wallet that you're not delivering the value, right? I mean,
let me give you a little small illustration on a different area. I was data processing manager at a dealership. And we had two computers running 11 stores, and both computers were down. They're apart in pieces on the floor. And coincident to that, we had all of the major publishers of the industry magazines and periodicals in the building for a day where we're presenting what our business did. So we're trying to really hype the brand. Coincident to that, chapter three, both machines were IBMs, which stands for It's Better Manual. And IBM had a strategy on customer service called Fill the Sky with Planes.
Fill the sky. They had
people there, baby. They were all over the place. And I'm the manager of the department, and they're running around. They're interfering with everybody. The theater is just down the hall about 100 feet, you know, so they can hear the cacophony. I get up on my secretary's desk and I say, okay, I want to see a show of hands. How many in here can actually fix this problem? Let me see. Three guys stuck their hands up. I said, the rest of you get out of here. And the three that were left, then we had a solution reasonably quickly. But it you know, it's not acceptable to be out like that anyways. Today, think about that. But they assigned somebody to me specifically, like a buddy. And I'd only been married about a year. And that sucker wanted to be with me from the time I arrived till the time I went home and everything else. You know, he met my wife and all the rest of this stuff. And at one point in time, I said, you know, I love you to death, man. You're not helping me at all. Get out of here. Go home. I said, well, I got to report every day to everybody. Call me.
I'll tell you. I got to fill out my CRM.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, think of the lunacy. And we have the same thing. What Alex indicated is, I think, absolutely right. The buyer of a machine is no longer baffled by specs, technology, systems. They grew up with it. It's common. It's easy for them. What they want to know is, how are you going to keep my costs down? How are you going to help me make money?
Mm-hmm. You know, so are we still in our own way filling the sky with planes, Ron?
Yes, sir.
By having a lot of people in certain roles that we think are like important traditionally?
Well, worse than that, Mets, I think, you know, my focus this year is on two subjects. One is the customer experience, Alex's expression. The other is the business model, because the business model has determined how our headcount is structured and how we cover our market.
Right.
And it was established, from what the research is that I've been able to find out, in the early 1980s.
Yeah.
When interest rates were at an obscene level and dealerships had to adjust the only variable cost that they had, which is payroll, in order to pay for interest and stay in business. And then we set our sales per employee numbers for that, and that's what we've been working with for the last 50 years. It's our 40 years. It's nuts. So we don't touch our customers. 80% of the people that buy from us don't get a contact initiated by us. They have to call us. You know, it's no wonder.
They have to call, physically call, right? Which is even more absurd, right? It's the whole point.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other little paragraph in there, because both of those things to me are aiming at loyalty, but the other paragraph is bricks and mortar. I don't want any more bricks and mortar. I'll put up tents. I need portable things. When I was at Finning, we had 53 stores. We had a model that we used, a financial model that we used to determine when we added a store.
Right.
And I always ask the question, where's the model to closing a store? They didn't have one. We had stores that shouldn't have been there.
Yeah, when they lose like $3 million a year for 5 years, then we close it.
Yeah, or whatever the number might be.
Yeah.
You know, that is big. At some stores, we were selling light bulbs. The community was so remote. I don't care what it is. I'll sell anything I can make a buck at that'll help the customer. Mr. Customer, what do you want? I'm here for you. I might not like what they tell me.
Well, I know a dealership that had Corvette engines in part stock, but that's a whole other story. Yes. You know, I thought this was a really interesting idea, like that the fill the sky with planes. And we talked about, you know, some people just want to talk to their service guy. Some people end up talking to this guy. And like in the world of, you know, phones and computers and emails and texts and all that kind of, and it can all be kind of monitored. You know, the fact that we haven't figured out what the preferred method is for every customer to contact. Like, who are they contacting? This customer, who are they calling out to? Like, I remember being in the shop and like my co-supervisor Kai, he was like the person that everyone loved, and half of the customers, he ended up going into sales for a short period of time because everyone thought like he should be a sales guy because he was the primary point of contact for the cat dealership for, you know, dozens of customers because he delivered. Like, he, you know, every time they called, he had a good answer and he delivered. And like, people are showing us where they want to go. They're showing us who they prefer, B, the channel they want to use, and C, like what part of the business they find the most value in. Like, we should be figuring out how to listen to that. Because then you could say, well, we only need half the sales reps, or we need two more over here, or we need, you know, these kind of sales reps that do this, because our customers are telling us that this is the channel they prefer. And this, you know, we've talked to this too, like audiences, you know, like we talk about this idea of segmenting our audiences, and you can find customers who are the old school guys and they still like their sales rep, and they'll use that sales rep until they go out of business or they hand the business off to someone else. But then that audience member goes to a different audience and they want to deal a different way. Like, I don't understand why we're still in many places using like this generic model of sales rep and PSSR and, you know, parts people and service people that's supposed to meet everyone, instead of measuring to see what customers are actually looking for. And saying these types of, this group of customers prefers this channel. So we establish that channel properly and match the customers so that they don't have to find their own way there, but we make it easy for them.
Technology is a great neutralizer in all of these things. If you do market segmentation, and I've been a proponent of that a long time, the way that I use a 6-digit segmentation code, and I try and have 4 variables within each. I can't always do it. Sometimes it's 6. But I'm looking at 1,000 segments that a dealership needs to cover based on machine population, relationships, payment patterns, loyalty, all this stuff. There's no way in the world that we can have 1,000 different strategies.
Ron, do you, I mean, you've talked to customers. Do you, to kind of getting back to what Metz was outlining, do you think enough customers are vocal about like the real reasons why?
That's, to me, that's a function of the salesman. There's nobody that I go call on, Alex, as you can probably imagine, that is quiet. You can't be in a room with me and be quiet. Even in a classroom with me, I refuse to have people sit there silent all day long.
And I just wonder, because, and I'm not trying to lead the witness, because maybe that's part of it. Maybe some dealers are blind because they really don't get honest feedback. I don't know. Like, I do feel like I had certain relationships with customers when I worked at a dealer where they were honest with me. But I've also noticed, like, not working for a dealer with some other customers, that the conversation was a lot different because I didn't have any skin in the game. Like, they didn't feel like they were insulting me by going somewhere else. Because it's clear that the one way that customers, you just have to be attuned to it, they vote with their money, right? But I feel like maybe a lot of customers just vote with their money, and then the dealers chalk it up as, well, we lost because of price. That's the only reason why we lost. And they don't know. I don't know.
I think it's a little bit of a biased survey when you lay it at the sales rep, right? Because the sales rep is one... We represent.
Hey, I'm doing a great job.
Yeah, right. Like, couldn't have been me. I was there all the time. You know, we had a great rapport. You know, we chatted all the time. But the customer A won't tell him that I chat with you, but you drive me nuts. Or B, they think that level of chatting is, you know, actually what that customer is also enjoying, or that's a measure of it. So that's kind of a tainted survey channel, but. Like, going to the data means that if you really monitor that customer, you see that like 3 times as many calls go to the service department from that customer than they go to the sales rep, or the other customer, you know, 3 times more calls go to their sales rep than they go to the service department, and the sales rep is then going to service. You know, like, we can monitor this. Like, all of these inbound channels can be monitored by phone number, by email, by whatever, to try and understand what's really happening. You say it, call it voting with your wallet, but we're voting with our communication channel every time too.
Yeah. And I think I was talking to a dealer principal a month ago or so. And I mean, and he's a really strategic thinker, really good guy. And he said to me, he's like, you know, and times are great for a dealer right now. And he was, you know, cautious about it. Cause he's like, you know, we're in an unprecedented time of inventory shortage. And, you know, there's a lot of people walking around here, like, you know, everything's great. And so I think there's that part of it too in this business where the dollars are so big, it covers for a lot of things that aren't done well. And it really does take a certain type of people within the business to be like, hey, you know, I'm not trying to be negative here, but we've got to be introspective, like, yeah. You know, especially today, you know. And so I think that it takes a special type of leadership to hit on these things.
You've got to want to see, like you said, you don't want to be negative, but you want to be honest. Mm-hmm. You want to be introspective and use like unbiased information to understand what's really happening in your dealership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the last 45 minutes that we've spent chatting back and forth are more justification than I needed to have more of these. The interesting thing, one of the interesting things, and Alex mentioned it, you gotta be neutral. You can't have. You gotta be a chameleon. You gotta be what your customer wants and needs you to be. And too often, the salesmen have not been coached or trained on how to and what to do. I used to do, in the consulting world, I used to do sales evaluations. I'd ride with a salesman for 2 or 3 days, and I'd watch them in front of customers, and then I'd start intervening with them, trying to coach them and show them different things. And it was always the same, and Alex will relate to this. They had a set of customers they wanted me to see with them. And I would leave with a customer list, and I figured it out after a day or so in your particular territory. I said, this guy's pretty close now, isn't he? He said, yeah. Well, let's go there. Well, I don't know if he's going to be there. Well, we got a phone. Let's call him. And he was there, and we showed up, and you walk in, and here's the customer saying, ah, good to see you. I know. When is the last time you were here? I mean, it's unbelievable. How about we wrap this at this point? Alex, what have you thought of the last 45 minutes? Is this a valuable discussion to have for people to hear?
Of course. I would love to get a high ranking dealer a part of this too, like somebody, you know, a manager, and just hear from their perspective too. You know, like I said, we're not trying to force anything. We're just trying to make the conversation more people have the conversation, like, because I think one of the ironies too about the technology piece, I was blind to, like, Caterpillar, who's the market leader who really doesn't want anything to change. They're the most aggressive investing in technology companies. I've met, I think, 5 founders now that they started a company, Cat bought it, you know, and it doesn't seem that the Bobcat is big into innovation as well. It doesn't seem like the ones that are competing with them are. They're like the most stubborn, where, you know, the market leader is like the most aggressive, but they keep a lid on it. But I would love to hear from a dealer managers for certain dealers, like what they feel about this kind of stuff and how they're looking at it.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Alex, on that one. This I subscribe to and read all kinds of industry things, as you can imagine. And I noticed this morning there's a podcast on technology controlling costs on the use of equipment on job sites. Mm-hmm. All Caterpillar.
Yeah.
So I sent off an email this morning about 5 o'clock, because I do a lot of this stuff in bed before I get out, to my guys at Deere and Volvo and Komatsu. I said, hey, do you do anything like this? And every one of them came back, geez, that's a wonderful idea. No, we don't. It just, you know, it amplified what you said, didn't it?
Right. Right. I mean, Kat does a good job of, like, I think keeping it under wraps, you know, like, let's not let these guys get any other ideas, but let's just gobble up all these other companies that have these cool tech ideas.
You got it. Mets, what do you think? Has this been a value?
It's always a value. It's both fun to work with you guys to flesh out these ideas and to communicate them. And I think it's challenging to try and get people to see the value in it. You know, that there is, things do work well, and dealers do well. And I just said do, but it's hard to get someone who's making money to reevaluate, mm-hmm. because there's a risk factor too, right? You could get it wrong.
Yeah.
Right as we were finishing up there about the sales reps and really mirroring your customers, I can remember what it was like when I started traveling to China for work in the short period of time that I wasn't in the industry. And eating dinner there was always interesting, you know, and I learned a really important lesson to always go a little slower and watch other people eat something or pick something up so that I would learn how to do it correctly, you know? And I think that applies in a lot of things, like doing, you can think that you know how to do things, but in the end, watching and learning, going maybe a little bit slower than you think you need to, means that you can pick up on the minutia. You can pick up on the important indicators that will help you actually do it better. And in my case, not embarrass yourself too badly at the dinner table.
But, I'm sure you did.
I've always tried to remember that.
Yeah. Guys, I think that's wonderful. Thank you both for participating in this, and to the members of the audience that are listening, thank you for listening. We hope you got things out of it, and I look forward to having you with us at another candid conversation in the near future. Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We appreciate your support. Should you have any thoughts or comments, please don't hesitate to contact us at www.learningwithoutscars.com. The time is now. Mahalo.